coming up on today's program.
I did the cutting and the sewing of the cloth for the airplane, that is the wings and the stabilizers. And
the Wright brothers and the women behind their aviation success. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend. As always, thanks for sharing your weekend with WISO. Our aviation combo, blue skies and tailwinds, and today from the Ohio Newsroom, coming up later in the program. Up first, the holidays can be a difficult time for those who have lost their spouse. But the village of Yellow Springs has a tradition dating back to 1894 that delivers baked goods and some good cheer to widows and widowers. WISO's Shea Frank rode along the village's annual distribution route to see how this longtime tradition still connects the community.
Good morning.
It's a chilly November morning in Yellow Springs as three public works staff visit with widows and widowers, delivering brown paper bags filled with flour and sugar. Many of the recipients have been part of the program for years, and despite the early morning hour, a number of them gleefully greet us in their pajamas, thanking the staff for their services.
Yeah, I think the impact is so subtly positive. I really appreciate it.
That was 87-year-old David Anthony. He's lived in Yellow Springs for 10 years. This is the first year he has been part of the program. His partner passed away last May. Anthony is one of 92 recipients this year, receiving 5-pound bags of flour and sugar. Altogether, these community members will receive 920 pounds of flour and sugar to use or donate for the holiday season. And all those pounds of pantry staples are prepared and loaded for distribution at Tom's Market on Xenia Avenue. It's been that way for as long as the market's owner, Jeffrey Gray, can remember. He says the store was part of the program long before his father, Tom, took over the market in 2001.
I mean, it's great that, first of all, that it's being done, so to take care of those people in need, and then also that the village is keeping that investment here in the community.
Gray says the distributions start the same each year. Public Works staff pile the products into trucks behind Tom's Market.
It's kind of like a fireman's brigade where they just unload it all out the back door and into the trucks. And I believe they take it to one of their shops or something and divvy it up into the individual bags and then drive around and deliver it.
The free deliveries are thanks to a longstanding agreement between the village of Yellow Springs and its successful community benefactor, Wheeling Gaunt. As a formerly enslaved person, Gaunt found acceptance in Yellow Springs in the 1860s. He began buying and selling real estate, eventually earning the status of the wealthiest man of color in Ohio. But his lifelong motto was, "It's not what you have, but what you share." When he died in 1894, he donated 9 acres to the village. Gaunt stipulated that proceeds from the land be used to help widows in the community around the holidays. Tanner Bussey, a member of Yellow Springs Public Works, says deliveries used to kick off the first week of December, but now they make their way to recipients prior to Thanksgiving.
Because of the holiday, there's a lot of cooking going on, and it seemed like a good time that, you know, you'd get ahead of it. And if you didn't cook for Thanksgiving, you'd have it available for Christmas.
Our second to last delivery of the morning is to 96-year-old recipient Nancy Lukowitz, who has lived in the village since the 1960s. Her daughter, Ann Lukowitz, says this is the fourth year they have received the gifts of flour and sugar.
I think that it's wonderful that we have this connection back to Wheeling Gaunt from, I think, over 100 years ago. It's wonderful that we still remember him, and it's wonderful that his bequest is still able to benefit people.
Before packing up for the day, Bussey looks back on the memories he has accumulated over the years, one of his fondest coming from a regular on Allen Street, Miss Simpson.
She would open the door and look at me surprised, and immediately her eyes would fill with tears. And I was just a stranger to her when I met, and I didn't really interact with her any other time but this time of year. And every year I'd bring it in, and every year she'd hug me, and every year she said, "I can't believe another year has passed. I'm so glad to see you again."
For WYSO News, I'm Shea Frank.
You guys, thank you very much.
Have a happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you.
A new season of Veterans Voices is underway, and this season we're exploring how service members transform their experiences into art. Here's the host for this season, Marine Corps veteran and musician Zach Sliver.
We kicked off the season of Veterans Voices at the Veterans Art Exhibition in the Rife Gallery in downtown Columbus, where the work of 23 veteran artists is now on display. Among them is Army veteran Lenny D. Anderson. For Lenny, the call to serve came early. The call to create came later.
When I was a kid, I used to go through magazines and I would collect all of the military advertisements. And I made a scrapbook. And so I always knew that I was going to go into the military, specifically the Army. When I eventually got out of the military altogether, my battalion commander called me into his office and asked what I was going to do. I said I was going to become an artist, which was the first thing that popped in my head. And he said, "Why an artist?" And I said, "Because I'm tired of people telling me what to do." And so I started as a poet and performance artist, and I was able to put together performances around Ohio. And eventually I was able to put together shows nationally. And because I was on the road a lot, I made the decision that I didn't want to be on the road. So I decided to teach myself how to paint.
The only formal art training Lenny ever had was a required art class back in junior high. But some of his friends owned a small coffee shop, and they let him hang a few of his early paintings on the walls. One day, somebody actually bought one for $20. That was the only encouragement he needed to keep going. From then on, Lenny just never stopped painting.
It's very cathartic because it allows me to take a lot of the negative energy, negative memories, and do something constructive and positive. My paintings are not really happy because of the theme of my work, but still it's positive because I'm getting that negative energy out of me. But with the military, you learn not to give up. Even when things become incredibly difficult, you have to find within yourself a way to muster through. So the military taught me how to persevere and accomplish what I want to accomplish. And because of that, I've been in the Smithsonian. My work has been spotlighted at the Kennedy Center, Japan. I've exhibited in Edinburgh, Scotland, Berlin, and Dresden, Germany. I've received a lot of fellowships and grants and awards. There's a number of veterans that have become very successful, and part of it has to do with the fact that there's this thing that's ingrained in us because of basic training and everything that we've experienced. But I've been fulfilling my comment to my battalion commander that I was going to become an artist.
Veterans Voices is presented by Wright-Patt Credit Union. Additional support comes from the Dayton Ombudsman Veterans Transition Team and Montgomery County Veterans Service Commission. Veterans Voices is produced here at the Eichelberger Center for Community Voices at WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WYSO Weekend. Well, it's been 122 years since the Wright brothers changed the world with their breakthrough flight in 1903. The weeks leading up to that achievement were full of hurdles and hard-earned lessons. Dan Patterson walks us through that story.
In the 21st century, it is possible to get from Dayton to the Outer Banks of North Carolina in a long day's drive. And we take that for granted. In 1903, that trip took 2 days of train travel with more than one transfer, and then about a four-hour boat ride across the wide Pamlico Sound, and they were hauling an untested airplane. The Wrights arrived in late September, along with their 1903 Flyer. Didn't have room in the cycle shop to fully assemble the airplane with the motor and propellers, all of which were their own design and construction, so they decided to put it all together once they got to Kitty Hawk. When you are the inventor, creator, as well as the hands-on guys turning the wrenches and swinging the hammers, you can make instant decisions to adapt. When they did get there, they found the shed they had built in 1902 had been blown off the foundations by the nasty Atlantic weather. Fixing that came first. Got to have a place to live, eat, and get out of the weather. Then they built a second shed in which to put all this together, the first airplane hangar. You know, this is a good spot to reinforce the majesty of the Wrights' accomplishments. They did all this on their own. In addition to solving the age-old quandary of flight and changing the world, they created the first principles of aeronautics, solved the math, the mechanics, the gasoline motor, created aerial propellers, were photographers, and by the way, they ran a bicycle business, and then had to build their own place to live and work on a desolate beach that took 3 days to get to. Any 21st century aviator will tell you that getting ready to fly is a process. Orville and Wilbur invented the process. Theirs including assembling the world's first airplane. Their motor worked, sort of. The vibrations caused by chain drives and whirling propellers cracked the steel tube shafts. Another more sturdy set arrived, and they cracked too. Now, the Wrights are known to be taciturn and stoic, but I have to believe that some form of astonished cursing and yelling had to happen. I mean, they're human beings. This time, Orville headed for Dayton to make shafts from spring steel. That's 3 to 4 days each way. He finally returned with the new hardware, and once installed, they tested the flyer, and all worked without another challenge. Time to fly, except for stuff like the weather. This time, not enough wind. They needed a good headwind to fly into. That way, they only needed to gain about 7 miles an hour to get airborne. Anxiety and impatience took over, so on the 14th, they gave it a try. They pointed the flyer into the winds, and Wilbur won the coin toss to try first. The flyer gained more speed than Orville could keep up with alongside, and the flyer rose into the air. The flyer climbed too steeply and stalled, settling into the sand. A few wood parts cracked. What mattered is that the flyer had taken off under its own power. They knew they had figured it all out. They got to work making the repairs, confident in their invention. The 17th dawned with ice on the roof and at least 25 to 30 miles an hour wind, cold air and steady winds. Crew from the life-saving station arrived to help them carry the flyer to the launch track and get set up. Orville set up their camera and asked John Daniels to trip the shutter when the flyer reached the end of the track. Now then, give that a thought. They were confident enough to anticipate where to focus the camera and ask for help to get the shot. Orville walked from the camera to the flyer and climbed aboard. It was his turn to try. The motor was started and warmed up, Wilbur alongside. Orville released the restraining wire, and the flyer moved down the track, picking up speed, faster than Wilbur could keep up. The flyer left the ground. A shadow appeared, and it flew into the wind. He flew about 120 feet and landed on ground the same elevation they had taken off from. They flew into history. They had achieved their goal. For WYSO, this is Dan Patterson, wishing you blue skies and tailwinds.
Blue Skies and Tailwinds is supported by the global aerospace and defense firm SNC and the Wright State University Aviation Science and Technology Program. And Ohio does call itself the birthplace of aviation, but the Wright brothers, Neil Armstrong and John Glenn, are far from the only contributors to the state's history of flight. And today we've got the story of two Dayton women who helped mankind reach the skies. The Ohio Newsroom's Kendall Crawford reports.
The Wright brothers' iconic liftoff from Kitty Hawk is immortalized in Ohio license plates, in museums, in photos, in documentaries.
As the two brothers prepare to attempt the first catapulted takeoff, man's age-old dream of flight becomes a reality.
That first plane, made of wood, wire, and cloth, was entirely the Wright brothers' handiwork. But after they proved flight was possible, their operation expanded. In 1910, they hired one of the first women to ever work in aviation.
This is our Idaho exhibit. We don't have a lot of things from her or on her.
At the Delphus Canal Commission, Bob Ebascotti walks me to a wall of black and white photos. They tell the story of Ida Holdgrave, a Northwest Ohio native who answered an ad for plane sewing. Only it was misspelled.
She was working in Dayton as a seamstress, and she saw an ad in the paper that said plane sewing, P-L-A-I-N sewing, and she thought, well, I'm a seamstress, I can make dresses or whatever. So she answered that ad.
Little did she realize she would be sewing fabric that would fly.
I did the cutting and the sewing of the cloth for the airplane, that is the wings and the stabilizers.
That's Holdgrave at 90, recounting her experience to a local radio station host. And while Holdgrave helped build some of the world's first flying machines, another Ohio woman helped them truly take off. The Wright brothers' kid sister, Catherine.
She was the unsung hero, really, of the story.
That's Tony Vandenbos, head of special collections and archives at Wright State University. The Wrights' mother died when Catherine was 15, and she became the head of the household, cooking, cleaning, and caring for her older brothers so they could focus on inventing flight. And once they did, she traveled to Europe promoting her brother's invention to skeptics, connecting with businessmen and charming reporters, work that her shy brothers couldn't have done themselves.
She took all that anxiety of the social demands of selling a flyer, making those networks with people. She took all of that off from Wilburn Orville, which was significant.
She was awarded France's highest merit for her contributions to aviation and was one of the first women to fly. But
she didn't get as much acclaim, you know, in the history books.
Her emotional and domestic labor, so central to the Wright success, was largely forgotten as flight moved into the mainstream. As for Holdgreave, she continued to sew for the skies, even after the Wright brothers sold off their airplane company, making World War II parachutes. But it wasn't until she was 88 years old, after years of working behind the scenes, that she herself flew for the first time.
How'd you like it?
Oh, it was nice. I didn't mind it.
Her contributions are now honored on Ohio's Air and Space Trail. Abiscotti says her courage and curiosity match the spirit of other early aviators.
She was someone that would go and do anything anywhere. She wasn't afraid to go from Little Delphus to Dayton to find work. And when she had a chance to work at an airplane factory, which, what's that? She went and did it.
Neither she nor Catherine were there for that first historic flight. But their work ensured it wasn't the last. For the Ohio Newsroom, I'm Kendall Crawford in Delphus.
That's all today from the Ohio Newsroom. We'll talk with you tomorrow.
You can catch Today from the Ohio Newsroom generally weekdays at 6:44 a.m. and p.m. during Morning Edition and All Things Considered right here on WYSO. Up next on WYSO Weekend, AI is ballooning and new data centers are popping up throughout the country to support growing demands for computing power. Two projects are in the works in Butler County. While they have some support from government leaders, some residents say they're worried about environmental consequences and energy use, and they're pushing back. WVXU's Isabel Nisley has the report.
Nearly every chair is filled at a Hamilton City Council meeting in mid-November. Longtime resident Terry Cunningham sits in the front row, shifting a stack of papers around in her lap. She says she hates public speaking, but she's here to make a point.
Question, have you considered the fact that we may not want more data centers?
She's talking about a proposed data center on 29 acres of wooded, city-owned land next to Miami University's Hamilton campus and about 50 homes. Another data center is underway up the road in Trenton. These facilities store computer systems. They're popping up throughout the country to support the growing demands of artificial intelligence.
One way to think about a single data center is that it is a big warehouse with a huge HVAC system and chips.
That's Yuri Dvorkin, an engineering professor at the Johns Hopkins University. He says data centers consume a lot of resources.
They don't run on air. They consume a lot of electricity, primarily for cooling purposes, to make sure that the chips that are used for training AI are being operated within a reasonable temperature range.
The data center proposed in Hamilton could need up to 240 megawatts of electricity at any given moment. Dvorkin says that's equivalent to the energy consumption of about 24,000 households. City Manager Craig Buchheit says he's interested in the data center's potential economic benefits, like up to 100 new full-time jobs. The developer Logistics has received some approvals for the project from the city, but Buchheit says the city still has much to consider.
We have to be open-minded and we have to be looking for opportunities, and so we do owe it to open the door and have a conversation and see if there's a path forward. Maybe there is, maybe there's not.
The city is waiting on two studies to determine how much power Hamilton could supply the project currently, if the city could generate more, and what infrastructure upgrades would be needed to deliver that higher load. Data centers' enormous demand for electricity is part of the reason why people in states like Ohio are seeing their bills get more expensive. And a major reason why people oppose these developments coming to town. Jay Kidd lives in Hamilton and owns a small business.
There are several concerns that I have and a bunch of us have about it. First and foremost, and this may sound a little bit selfish, but there's the utility cost involved.
Buchheit says Hamilton residents would be shielded from any price increases. The city owns and operates its electric utility and generates most of the power it needs.
It'll have very little or no impact on their utility bill because it's not going to come from the power that we currently generate. Power for this project would be sourced by us on the open market, and then we pass that power through to the developer at cost. So the cost associated with sourcing that power and bringing it here would be passed on 100% to the developer.
Buchheit says the developer is paying its own way, including for facilities and infrastructure related to the project. Some Hamilton residents aren't buying it. People like Terry Cunningham are worried the city could be opening its doors to more data center developers.
I've studied a lot of other communities and the nightmare that the data centers are entailing.
People living next to data centers in Virginia report the noise makes it hard for them to spend time outside, and bright lights keep them up at night. And high water use by a data center in Georgia has tanked water pressure for some residents. Cunningham wants to prevent that from happening in Hamilton. She and others created a Facebook group called the Coalition Against Data Centers in South Ohio. It has more than 600 members. They're circulating a petition, creating yard signs, and speaking out at biweekly city council meetings, even when the data center isn't on the agenda.
It's a big monster to try to fight. I just, every day I say, well, I'm going to give up. And then the next day I'm like, you know, back on it again. I can't stop fighting this because it's so horrendous.
They're worried about water use, noise, and pollution. The coalition wants the city to scrap the project. They say they'll be at every city council meeting until that happens. For the Ohio Newsroom, I'm Isabel Nisley.
Westchester is revising its almost year-long business development moratorium. WISO's Catherine Mobley reports that while trustees support the changes for the almost year-long measure, some business owners want the moratorium to be in effect for only a few months.
Currently, Westchester is home to about 3,600 businesses. However, there's a revised business development moratorium now in effect for its main business district, the Cincinnati-Dayton 747 corridor. Township Administrator Lisa Brown explains.
The biggest takeaway is that if it's a blank piece of land, then it would not be permitted to construct a new building, whether it's a parcel by itself or basically an ancillary structure to a principal structure, so no new buildings.
The affected corridor is about 3,200 acres along Union Center Boulevard. During the moratorium, the township wants a comprehensive impact study to evaluate traffic, land use patterns, environmental impacts, infrastructure capacity, and future development. Trustee Lee Wong contends temporarily stopping development in this area will allow the township to develop a sustainability strategy.
We have limited land left in this area, Union Center. And we have to be very careful of future development, what next 50 years is going to bring us. So I think this is necessary.
Tuesday night, during the trustees' meeting, the three-member board unanimously approved and passed this revised measure, overriding the original development moratorium approved in October. During the November 18th public meeting, a number of business owners complained that first measure was too broad. They say it halted projects they had already spent money on. However, Brown assures this revised moratorium allows them to complete most enhancements.
Most of the normal operational changes that would be made to existing buildings would be permitted. Tenant fit-outs and other general alterations, painting, fencing, exterior signage, and some other general things.
According to Brown, it also enables proprietors to expand a principal building no more than 60% of the size of the main structure. The addition must be connected directly to the principal building. During the meeting, no business owners objected to the newly revised development moratorium. It's slated to stay in effect until October 2026. However, Chris Warnenberg urged trustees to move swiftly with the comprehensive impact study. He's the development director for Shoemaker Dugan Construction, a major local enterprise.
A lot of properties and a lot of people are going to be without the ability to use their properties if they're building new and or expand their properties if they need to expand more than 60%. And I can't imagine it would take 10 months or 11 months to decide what needs to be done here. Okay. We got the interchange approved in less time.
Township Administrator Lisa Brown estimates Westchester currently has 12 to 13% of commercial land available for development. Reporting for WYSO News, I'm Catherine Mobley.
Up next, a little more in the way of the world of flight.
This is Bird Note. A few times each year, the eastern paradise Wyda puts on its party clothes. This small finch, found in East Africa, is just 5 inches long, with a black tail, brown back, and patterned face markings. But when it's time to mate, the male molts into breeding plumage. His head turns glossy black, his neck golden yellow, and breast a vivid orange. But the best part? He sprouts extravagant, long, black tail feathers 2 or 3 times the length of his body. The male paradise Wyda's tail feathers are not just super long, but also broad, as if they belong to a much bigger bird. It almost looks like the bird is wearing a long black cape. That's how it got its nickname, the widow bird, because it looks like a widowed woman in black mourning clothes. It's a competitive scene during breeding season, with lots of long-tailed males chasing one another. The more a male gets chased, the more likely he is to grow a slightly shorter tail, which could make it harder for him to stand out for the ladies. So just remember, never underestimate the power of a good party outfit. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Bird Note, putting a wrap on this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks so much for joining us this weekend. We've got more stories and conversations for you next weekend. Please join us then. Our theme music was provided by Magnolia Bolthead, and this program is a podcast. You can download and subscribe wherever you find your podcasts. We'll see you next time.
For roots music on WYSO, Sundays are the place to be. Wake up at 6 a.m. with Jennifer Berman and Chloe Maynor for a mix of folk, Americana, and bluegrass on Rise When the Rooster Crows. All Things Louisiana at noon with Lindsay Young on Louisiana Byways. Explore Celtic sounds with Cindy Funk at 1 p.m. with A Dear Green Place. If you like the blues, join Eric Henry at 3 with The Blues Revival. Then enjoy the old-time country sounds with me, Tom Duffy, on a country ramble at 6 p.m. That's Roots Music Sundays here on 91.3 WYSO and WYSO HD2 Novaphonic FM.